Support for the National Writers Series is brought to you by the Wege Foundation, dedicated to developing leaders in economicology, health, education, and arts, and enhancing the lives of people in West Michigan and around the world.
Welcome to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. The Curse of Oak Island is a TV show on the History Channel, currently in its seventh season. It's also now a book by journalist Randall Sullivan. Randall first wrote about the island for Rolling Stone in 2004. In the book, he goes deeper into the long history of treasure hunting on the island and delves into the many theories about what's buried there. One of the creators and stars of the TV show is engineer and entrepreneur Marty Lagina. Randall and Marty talk this hour with Patrick Livingston, news director for TV stations WPBN and WGTU in Traverse City. Patrick asked Randall why people are so interested in Oak Island.
Well, it's a bottomless mystery. I mean, people love mystery. It's such an essential part of being a human being, and it holds us, it sustains us, and a mystery that can't be solved but has so many possible solutions and that so many people feel like they can participate in solving with their own ideas. I think that's kind of what feeds the fascination with Oak Island.
So when you started this book and you went into it and your beliefs then and when you finished the project, what changed for you, if anything?
Between the start of the project
and what you're going in and then when you finished everything into the history?
Well, you have to come to terms with the fact that you're not going to solve the mystery of Oak Island writing a book. I'm writing a history of the treasure hunt and of what we know about the island. So, you know, I want to explore that history and all the possible theories and everything that people have done there and lost there and invested there. But I wasn't going to get behind or advocate any particular theory. And what I really found was tremendous relief whenever I could find a theory that I could actually dismiss, because there's plausibility in about, I don't know, at least 100 theories. And I think your brother probably would say maybe 1,000 theories have some plausibility.
Yeah, it's a good thing he's not here, actually, yeah. Actually, I want to say something about that clause you just read, because I did read the book, and it's a damn good read, Randall. It's a good read. It really is. I learned some stuff or relearned that I had forgotten about the history, but it's good I didn't read that clause because I missed it, because goodness gracious, I'd quit. I mean, it's all for naught.
No, I didn't say all for naught.
You said all for naught.
Yeah. Little editing. Yeah.
I thought so. Anyway, it's a good read.
So, same question that I asked Randall. What has changed since you begun this quest and until now? Yeah.
What has changed since I began this quest? Well, I learned a lot about failure because, you know, the terrifying thing about your book, Randall, and it's terrifying to a guy like me, is that I mark them here. There are at least 4 or 5 places where a succession of searchers came in and said, with the latest technology, we'll have this figured out in weeks, maybe months, that's it. And you know what? I said that. And I learned that that island is tougher than that. It's a combination of some unique geology, some things we still can't understand, but we've been at this now for pretty close to 10 years. And we did bring the most modern technology, and we haven't solved it just yet, but we're getting close. So anyway, it took a long time.
So did you think after that first year, because are we going to keep doing this, and now we're going into in season 7?
Have you met Rick Lagina?
Yeah. No, I have not, but I've watched him.
You think I was going to quit after the first season?
So he wouldn't let you quit?
I don't think so, no.
So let's talk about some of the people and that have gone through this journey and all the treasure hunters that have come and gone. And I'm just going to mention some names, and you guys can talk about them. Frederick Blair, Samuel Ball, William Chappell, Robert Restall, Fred Nolan. Some of the guys that have come before you and tried to find this treasure in your research.
You just
talk about
bridged
them.
About 150 years
I
of
did,
history
yeah.
there. So and out of order. So I'll try to take them in order. I mean, Frederick Blair was, I think, he was the first great historian of Oak Island. He really collected all of the, everything that had been done before him, all of the available data, all of the reports, all the records. I think it was a lot like Rick in his approach to, you know, his obsessive approach to utter absorption in the mystery. And many people had to pass through him, and many people inherited it from him. And his conviction that it was something profound, I mean, I think he was the first to really make a, well, I don't know if he made a convincing case, I guess his life was the convincing case, that there was something more than gold and silver. Oak Island was about something more than gold and silver. He was obsessed with the tiniest clue that's ever been pulled up out of the ground on Oak Island, which is a fragment of parchment paper with India ink writing on it. And when that came up out of the money pit area, he realized that what's down there might not be the treasure as he had conceived it, but some sort of cultural artifact or something like that. So he was a very significant figure. Samuel Ball goes back much earlier, and he's a mysterious figure. He was a black slave in the Carolinas who won his freedom during the Revolutionary War by fighting on the British side, which was something that was offered to them. Migrated to Nova Scotia and then settled on Oak Island with nothing. He was allegedly a cabbage farmer, but somehow he managed to acquire, you know, hundreds of acres of land, you know, build a significant little estate and even have a private servant. So he had some source of income that has been a mystery. And in the earliest published history of Oak Island, first one between hardcovers, in the first edition, they described the three people who discovered the money pit as being Daniel McGinnis, who was, really was the first, and John Smith, and Ball, Samuel Ball. But in the second edition by the same author, Samuel Ball's removed, and it becomes Anthony Vaughan, who, so, you know, that's the kind of confusion that is layered through the Oak Island story, and Ball is a very mysterious character, although I have a feeling you guys are gotten a little more knowledge than the last year.
Well, we have, but it's amazing how many mysterious characters lived on that island, which you know better than anybody. I mean, we had privateers, and the thing was surveyed into 4-acre lots, in like 1760, you know, this is a period of time when you're buying things like Louisiana, you know, the Louisiana Purchase. Why are people buying 4-acre lots on a little tiny, non-strategic island in Mahone Bay? I mean, and it's one thing after another like that, as you know, and all kinds of really interesting characters, culminating in the ones that are there now, I guess. But anyway, it's quite a story. You can't. Well, you did it justice in a book, but it's hard to do it justice in a few minutes.
How much research before you went to the island did you look at these guys and what they had done and the mistakes that they made? How much did you research that before you got into this?
I did a lot of, you know, what's available in written form, and there'd been a lot of things written about Oak Island. And but, I mean, until I got there, actually got to Nova Scotia, and I arrived with the idea that, okay, I'm going to go back to the very beginning. The origin story, as they call it, the origin myth, a lot of people call it, of how it was discovered. And I started looking into, because you had told me, I think over breakfast one day, that you weren't even sure that Daniel McGinnis existed, or that...
Did I say that?
Yeah, I think you did say that. And that provoked me, Marty. And so I am
the designated cynic on that island.
Yeah, he is indeed. So I actually found some McGinnis family members who put together a biography of Daniel McGinnis, but they said he was 38 years old when he found the money pit, not 16, as the story has gone, and they had a lot of information about him. So really, I would say genealogists were the single best source, because they helped me go back through the records and establish that Daniel McGinnis was the father of the 16-year-old Daniel McGinnis, who actually did discover the money pit, and that the three people who, quote, discovered the money pit were teenage boys.
And I think Robert Rexdahl and his son lost their lives when we were there, and I thought there was something interesting in the book, and I think that's the daughter, Lee Lamb, that's been on the show and in your book, and she said, there's a darkness to this place even when the sun shines. Do you feel that on the island when you walk on it?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, it's both. I mean, at times it's a beautiful place, okay? You should all come see it. It's a beautiful place. It's got these brilliant views of the sea and such, but then it'll turn because these fogs come rolling in off the ocean, which when you visited the first time. And then it's very eerie. Strange things happen there. I mean, I don't want to get into all that, but it can be both. It can be beautiful and welcoming, and it can be downright eerie.
Well, when I arrived there in 2003, the island was basically static and semi-abandoned. There were two people living on the island, an old married couple, and they weren't letting anybody on the island. I had to talk my way on. I had to talk my way past Dan Blankenship.
So did we.
And you can imagine what that's like. But it was gloomy and misty. It had a very eerie feel to it. All the abandoned equipment that, you know, just, it was like layers of decades and centuries. It was like a museum of failure. You know, sorry.
That's what we purchased.
Museum of failure.
Thank you very much.
But honestly, I met Lee Lam and her brother, the surviving Restalls, and that was the thing that really made me feel like I must be destined to do this, because the first day I was on Oak Island happened to be the first day that they had come back to Oak Island since the 1960s, since the tragedy that ended their father's life and the oldest brother's life and basically destroyed their mother. And that added to my feeling that this is a haunted, spooky, kind of scary place. And it was scary for me to wander around the island by myself. And when it started to get dusk, you know, I felt, I don't want to be here after dark.
Well, I think, Marty, you tell the story, I don't know if it was on a bet with Rick, but you went out one night and you felt something.
Let me be clear before I even go here, okay? I don't believe in any of this cursed stuff, okay? But it scares the hell out of me. I did go out there. No, I don't believe it. I mean, I try and look at things logically and scientifically. I don't buy curses, okay? But I did go out there. Rick said, "Well, you go out there and spend, you know, a couple hours by yourself back at 10X. So I went back there. I wasn't back there 10 minutes. And I hear this blood-curdling scream. Now, it was probably an owl or something, let's just say. It scared the bejibbers out of me. I jumped in the car, and I almost ran Rick over. He hadn't even... He hadn't got more than about 100 yards down the road, and I was already screaming at him. He said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Oh, nothing. I just don't want to do this." So, yes, that happened.
Yeah, yeah.
And, Randall, tell the story, and I think it was the one that you scared you the most or you thought about a lot with Dan Henske, I believe, and what happened to him.
Well, that was the story that scared me most the first time I went to Oak Island. And Dan, as you know, anybody who's watched the show, he's been a treasure hunter on Oak Island for more than half a century, and knows the island, you know, physically as well as anybody, and he became convinced that it was a spooky, haunted, terrible. Well, actually, what he became convinced was that the money pit was the entrance and the exit from hell, and that all these demons were going to be coming out. And it's strange that when he told me, I'd had this thought. It was an insane thought. You know, it just passed through my mind quickly when I was standing by the money pit the first time, that, well, maybe this wasn't about, you know, burying something there. It was, they were like trying to keep something in, you know. But I thought, well, that's a strange thing to think. And then Dan tells me, you know, that story, and it caused a nervous breakdown. He swam.
Wait, you had a nervous breakdown?
Well, I nearly did just listening to him talk about his nervous breakdown, really.
I think just what you said a little bit, you wrote in your book that Oak Island was not designed to keep men out, but it kept something else, something terrifying, in.
Yeah, that I'm just saying that thought struck me, and then when Dan told me his story, you know, it raised the hairs on the back of my neck.
And what is it?
Well, something evil. That was my thought, and he made it specific about, you know, he put it in a Christian context.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, Randall Sullivan talks more about his latest book, The Curse of Oak Island, the story of the world's longest treasure hunt. Thank you.
You're listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. Let's return to Patrick Livingston's conversation with Randall Sullivan and Marty Lagina.
There's been so many theories of what's buried there, if anything, and it's been a weave through everything. Does things change daily for you when you're going through all this as far as what's buried there, what's not?
Yeah, I mean, of course, because can anybody else think of a serious treasure hunt where the treasure hunters don't even know what they're looking for? I mean, that's what we've got here. What brings everybody to that island is this concept that how could anybody have created these ridiculously complex underground workings with one of the most sophisticated booby traps you can imagine. I mean, like something you don't even really see in the movies. And so you have to then jump to, well, must have been for a real super reason. And that's what's brought people back there for 230 years. And, you know, the cynic in me thinks, geez, I hope it wasn't the world's biggest practical joker that did this, because...
Well, that would be somebody with quite a sense of humor.
Yeah, quite a bad sense of humor and a deep pocket, too. But, you know, that's it. And so that's why, and Randall's done a great job of elucidating some of these theories, that's why so many are plausible, because we don't know for sure what we're looking for. So you can bring in a plausible theory about virtually anything.
But you know that people did these extraordinary works on the island. There had to be an extraordinary reason. I mean, you know, that's what is so compelling about...
Yes, but I want to say one other thing for myself. One of my theories was that nothing happened on Oak Island.
I remember that theory, Martin.
And that it is collective madness. That this guy did it because that guy did it, and that guy did it because that guy did it, and et cetera, right up to the modern day. And it was all misinterpreted. So I used to think that, but I don't think that anymore, because what we have uncovered, some of which I can tell you and some I can't, I used to think that maybe nothing happened prior to the money pit, that really the whole saga belonged in the psychiatry books, not in the archaeological books. So... But the point is, I don't think that anymore, because we have some pretty good scientific proof that some really odd things happened long before that discovery by McGinnis.
So let's just run through some of the things. Captain Kidd's gold was there, a pirate bank, manuscripts from Shakespeare, a connection to the Knights Templar and its treasures. Talk about some of those theories.
Well, it's amazing to me that the Captain Kidd theory really endured and was the theory of Oak Island for the first century of the treasure hunt. And a lot of that has to do with what a mythic figure Captain Kidd was. I really didn't know before I started researching this book what a, you know, sort of a martyr figure he was. He was not like the, you know, bloodthirsty pirate he's been portrayed as. He was somebody who was basically a political pawn forced into working as a privateer, which was a kind of pirate. But his execution was a huge public drama in the London of the time, and at the last minute, to try to save his life, he said, look, I've got a fabulous buried treasure on an island, and I will get, you know, I'll lead you to it if you spare my life. They didn't do it. They hung him in public and left him in a steel cage to rot for 2 years, but publicly. But it turned out he had buried at least one treasure on an island. It was found on Gardner's Island, which is off the coast of Long Island. But the treasure wasn't nearly as significant as what people assumed Kidd had put somewhere. So all up and down the Atlantic seaboard at that time, people were convinced there was a Captain Kidd treasure on some island. So it wasn't as outlandish as we might think for those kids to think, Captain Kidd's treasure, that's what we found here. But what amazes me is that endured as basically the story for 100 years before they started to consider other alternatives.
Yeah, and that's one of the cool things about Oak Island is that it does bring real history in. You know, what we're doing is, you know, what we're doing. But when you research these things, I mean, Kidd was a tragic figure.
He was.
Really. He got on the wrong side of the authorities, which I've done myself once in a while. And I didn't end up in a cage over the Thames, but it wasn't pleasant. So, You know, he was really a tragic figure. He was maligned. He didn't really do much at all.
No, he was basically, you know, their political pawn. He was, you know, he was doing what he thought he had to do to survive and protect his family.
Yeah, bottom line, it's not kids' treasure. You would agree, would you not?
I would. Yeah. I would absolutely agree with that. It's not the French crown jewels either.
So what to both of you, what's to both of you the most plausible of all these that you have heard?
Well, you know, I told you early on that I just can't see that this kind of work would have been done by people who were concealing a treasure of gold or silver or gems or anything of material value. People must have been motivated by something, you know, like religious belief or cultural commitment or, you know, some larger purpose. I just can't see why, you know, come on, if you're going to bury loot and you're going to come back and get it eventually, you know, you just wouldn't go to those lengths. So, you know, to me, it's got to be one of those theories that has to do with either, you know, religious objects or, you know, cultural artifacts or something that's a combination of both.
Marty, do you lean that way?
You know, I have to say, I'm really not sure, which is a real cop-out, I know. But we are, you know, I like to think of myself as a data guy. And I disagree a little bit with Randall, and he's really being a surrogate for my brother right now, because you feel exactly like he does, exactly, that it's way more than gold and jewels. But, you know, there is a sufficient amount of gold and jewels that's worth protecting as well. And as we uncover things, there may be some remaining historical connections yet to be revealed, which is all I can say right now. But I think it could have been actual treasure. What bothers me, in fact, I think there's a really good chance it was actual monetary treasure, maybe more. What bothers me is that maybe there were recovery attempts, and maybe there were recovery successes.
Yeah.
And that's...
That would be discouraging.
Yeah, that's very discouraging. Yeah, I've got to read that first paragraph of your book again there. But I don't think so. I think there's something there. I don't know. There are probably four or five plausible theories.
Well, of all the gold and silver theories, I mean, the one that makes the most sense to me is the treasure of Havana. So
it would probably be tied to some of the plundering of the New World, some aspect of it, you know, either the Spanish galleons or, you know, I mean, they would be the prime suspects, I guess, in several different theories. But maybe not. I mean, there's something going on there for sure on the island to do with the French government, for sure, I think. There's something went on there to do with the British government, I think. And there may have something going on in that island that has to do with the American government. That's all I'm saying.
Well, you've covered the bases.
Yeah, I have.
So last night, the History Channel had the 25 top finds on the island. Let me ask, what are your top three or your five, the most important things to you? And I don't know if you had a hand in...
I can do for sure. The most important finds to me is... A lot of what we did out there was try and find out on these apocryphal stories which ones were real and which ones weren't. So believe it or not, the discovery of this coconut fiber was very significant to me because I started out doubting everything. Maybe it's all made up. It's all just collective madness. But there is a lot. We find it all over the place, actually. Not in huge quantities anymore, but... So there's coconut fiber on the island, and that fits the stories. It doesn't fit Nova Scotia. So that's significant. And then those bones, the human bones found, I struggle with that every time I think about it. I mean, if you want to make up a reason, a mundane reason for human bones at 160 feet, it's not easy to do.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's difficult. That's pretty significant. And then once we got into the dendrochronology dating, which is highly accurate, and found out that there are definitely substantial things prior to the discovery of the money pit. So I would say those three.
As you have such a great cast, and you all work so well together, it seems. And I think I told you at lunch today, what's so great about that show is I feel like I'm on the island with you guys, and I'm just kind of listening in. Y'all click so well together.
Well, not all the time, but but you know what? We call it the fellowship of the dig, and it is. We have a common goal, and it's nice. It's very nice.
So talk a little bit about making this. I mean, we see it all tied up very neatly on TV, but how much shooting goes into what we see in an episode?
A lot. And I actually do want to say something about that. When we did not pitch this show, we didn't want to do it. We initially said no, we didn't want anything to do with TV. And then this Kevin Burns character that runs Prometheus, very persuasive guy. Do you
know?
Yeah. But we did. I think what's different about this show, and we've learned this from the cameramen, and I think you talked to some of them too, yeah. That almost all the reality shows you see, folks, are scripted. You know, they're told what to say. Not all of them, but most of them. And we said early on, look, we're not going to do that. We're not actors. Any more than having been a businessman for 40 years, Robert. You know, we are actors, I guess, but not in that sense. And we say we wouldn't do scripted, and we're not going to do fake fights, and we're not going to do stuff that we see on other shows. And I think the audience relates to that. I think they do. I think they can sniff out that that's not happening. What they see is real. But it takes, to answer your question now, it takes a long time. You get mic'd at 8 in the morning, and then everything you say all day is recorded. Which is disconcerting, and then probably oftentimes maybe 7:30 at night, probably, yeah. You know, you're done. And they just shoot, everything you're doing, and then it's the show is produced by the editors.
Yeah, and they use a minute of that 12 hours you put in.
Do you get so engrossed, though, in what you're doing that you forget? I know there's a lot of people there, but...
I'd say half the time, absolutely, forget the cameras completely, particularly when some exciting stuff happens. You know, you've... Initially, like I say, I have no acting training, so initially you're always looking at the camera, but that goes away, and you forget about it after, you know, something exciting's happened. We do sometimes have to, you know, do like drive-ups 3 or 4 times, and that's terribly annoying. Drives Rick crazy because he's a get-out-of-the-car-and-get-to-work kind of guy, and I guess I'd like to think I am, too.
You have to pretend to meet the same person 4 or 5 times
for
the
first time. Yeah, that sort of thing, So there's a lot of drudgery shooting too, but what you see is real.
Randall, did you have a good time on the show? I know you've been on several
episodes. I did, and something I'd really add to what Marty's saying is that what's unusual about that show is that the crew is into it.
Yes.
The crew is, you know, they are caught up in the treasure hunt. They're excited about it. You know, they that's unusual, tells you how, you know, compelling it is for.
Yeah, the
for
producers to have to tell them. Not to do it. Don't get so of it. You'll see
some
of the cameramen.
You don't see that on other shows.
You'll see them digging around after hours out there. Seriously.
But for me, working on the show was like, for a writer, that was like a dream gig. I mean, they paid me a good salary to be able to follow me around and while they were funding my research, to follow me around while I was researching a book. I was getting paid to let them put a camera on me while I was researching the book. That's the best deal I've ever gotten.
Marty, you've got to go to some different off the island and all different shoots across the world. What are your favorite, or what are some of the stories you can tell us about that?
You know, that sort of thing is kind of a rush. I mean that in the sense that you're rushed, not that it's a rush. You don't really have a lot of time, you know, because of, you know, scheduling stuff. And I haven't done that much. Rick has actually done more than I have. And I would say this is absolutely true, folks. Really happened that Rick went to that unscripted, unprepared, went to that prison where they held the Templar Knights, real stuff, real facts, looked at all the engravings on the wall that these poor condemned guys actually carved into the stone with their teeth, is what we were told, because they had nothing to do, they wanted to leave some sort of record, they wouldn't give them any sort of steel, obviously, so they would actually make these carvings. I mean, it's amazing. But then he comes back to Oak Island and they find that lead cross.
Yeah.
And he remembers, and he's absolutely correct. It rings a bell. And none of that was fake. That was all real. That here's this thing he finds that fits right into that drawing on the wall. That was really amazing.
Yeah.
And that was well worth the travel.
It flabbergasted me.
Yeah.
So in shooting, what are some of the most favorite episodes for you and that you remember?
I remember the fun stuff. I mean, there have been occasions. My brother Rick is so passionate about it. I mean, he would get mad at me for saying this, but I'm going to say it anyway. It's almost like a religious fervor with him.
Oh, yeah.
and it's not for me. I mean, I'm intrigued by the challenge. but it's not the same. And he just holds it in such high regard, so it weighs on him. You know, I make the comparison to Frodo in Lord of the Rings. It's like he's wearing this ring, you know, and it's wearing on him. And seriously, that's I think that's about right. So there have been occasions, I'm getting to the point, there have been occasions where he's been happy. You know, we've had a find, you know, we did the deal where we jumped off the pier and went, you know, when, here's a way to put it. When I feel like we're young boys again, that's what I enjoy the most.
And do you feel that way most of the time that you're
no.
doing this?
No. No.
Let's talk a little bit about the other things that go into this shooting. You and I talked a little bit about at lunch, that the political part of this and being on the island and having the permits and doing all this. Talk a little bit about that behind the scenes.
I will say this, that there's always that in any sort of business nowadays, and there are environmental concerns here. The government of Canada has been great. They are, I'm not going to say they're easy because they're not. They're diligent, but they have worked with us really well, timely. You know, we've gotten the permits we needed to get. Some have taken a while, but it's all been, it's never had the moments that I've had sometimes here in these United States where you think, oh my God, what are they thinking? You know, we haven't had that. They've worked with us. And then the people of Nova Scotia have also been great. The support there is fantastic. So I have no complaints about any of that. And also Rick does most of it, so let's be
And they're very happy to have you there.
Yeah, it's been good for the province.
They passed an Oak Island law. It's the only place in Canada where you can hunt for treasure, or Nova Scotia. In Nova Scotia, hunt for treasure and keep it. So that's how much they value what's going on there.
Yeah, the law is specific to Oak Island. Anywhere else in Nova Scotia, if you find treasure, it belongs to the government. Only on Oak Island.
Randall, any plans to go back to the island and make a guest appearance?
Well, I mean, have you talked to Kevin Burns about that? I don't know. I mean,
of course he's going to come back.
Yeah, well, I have to, you know. I've got to update the paperback. But, and I wish, you know, I could tell them what an exciting season they've got coming up.
So in the 7 years or 8 years that you've been doing this, has there ever been a time that you said, you know what, that's it, I'm ready to quit? Or is that the end of every season for you?
Several times a season, actually, seriously. You know, I mean, it's daunting. And you know, there have been several times that I've thought, this is not worth the continued effort. Yeah, I have.
So how much time does this take for you in the shooting? I know you've done some things in the winter, but tell us a little bit about the shooting schedule and the things that you go with that and the travel.
Well, Rick is out there probably from about May 1st till November 15th, pretty much steady. Craig and I don't know if Craig's here tonight, Craig and I go back and forth because we've got some stuff we're still doing here. I probably every other week. During that period, maybe not quite that much. It's a lot.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, Randall Sullivan and Marty Lagina talk more about the TV show and book, The Curse of Oak Island.
Listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Doug Stanton. Let's return to Patrick Livingston's talk with Randall Sullivan, author of the book The Curse of Oak Island, and Marty Lagina, co-creator and star of the TV show.
the relationship that you have with the people that, that come on, you know, some of the descendants of the people that have searched for the gold, that seems to be very special. And the episodes I've seen with Lee Lamb, and just talk a little bit about how that connection you all have.
Well, again, that's more a Rick thing. I mean, because he puts such a high regard for this whole quest, and I'm talking about not ours, the whole 230 years, that he reveres these people who came before, you know. And their stories are amazing. The perseverance is amazing. The you know, what happened to the Restalls is just, you know, Shakespeare couldn't have written a better tragedy than that. I mean, it's highly tragic. And they persevered against incredible odds, and that's admirable. But, you know, also at some point you have to question whether it was rational. And that's where maybe Rick and I part company. So, yes, do we have respect for these people before? Absolutely. Was everything they did rational? I say maybe not.
And it struck me, and you wrote about it in the book, and that's that all these people were willing to lose everything, and some did financially and family-wise and everything, and yes, they just kept going.
Some very successful businessmen, you know, went way in debt to finance the treasure hunt on Oak Island. That with that convinced that consume that committee.
I hate to say it, but I think most fit that bill. Most spent the rest of their lives and their finances, and they only quit when they either died or ran out of money.
Yeah.
God, that sounds awful.
Well, when somebody's as rich as you are, Marty, they don't have to worry about the seconds.
But were.
How tough was the research for this book? Because you really get into just about everything, to the minute details. Talk a little bit about the research
and how long did it take you to do that?
I did,
because I felt like I had Rick Lagina looking over one shoulder and Marty occasionally peering over the other. I mean, I really did feel their presence, and especially Rick, because he is such a student of Oak Island. And I mean, you go out to dinner, I go out to dinner with your brother, and he does not talk about anything but Oak Island. You go out with Marty, and there's all kinds of subjects, from poetry to, you know, petroleum, you know, engineering. But, I mean, Rick talks about one thing and one thing only, and that is Oak Island. And so, but he's got this tremendous commitment to, you know, and this omnivorous sort of appetite for it. And I really felt like I wanted to deliver a book he would respect as the history of Oak Island. And maybe...
And he does.
I appreciate hearing that. And throw a few things that would, you know, he hadn't considered at him.
You know, he tells a story on himself that I just heard the other day, where he said, Alex, my son, told him that at Christmas time, if he saw Rick coming towards him with a serious look on his face, he would try and run away because he knew he was going to hear about Oak Island again.
Randall, was there anybody in your book that you were trying to talk to that you didn't get to, that you regret? And was there a dead end perhaps that you really wanted to go and it just stopped there?
Really only the Samuel Ball family. I mean, I was able to find the main surviving relative who intimated that he had some knowledge that, you know, was held within the family. And I just couldn't get him to give it up. And then I turned the information over to you guys, and I guess you got somewhere.
We're still working. Actually, there's a bona fide archaeological dig going on in the Samuel Ball Foundation right now. Because that guy, you talk about, again, somebody who succeeded against odds, you know, born a black slave at that day and age, earns his freedom, comes to Nova Scotia with nothing, and dies a wealthy, respected man.
Yeah.
You think that was easy? I don't think so. And how he really got there, that's what you're wondering.
Yeah, yeah. And how involved he was in the original, you know, discovery and the works.
You know, I thought it was interesting, too, about Fred Nolan, who did a lot of stuff, but he kept everything to the vest. And he was a tough guy, but he softened near the end and was ready to give up some information?
Sort of.
You want a Fred Nolan story?
Yeah.
I'll give you a Fred Nolan story. So Rick and I are sitting in a golf cart with Fred Nolan towards the end of his life. And he was all about this swamp, you know, don't get me going on swamp. But Fred Nolan, you know, we're sitting in there, and yeah, he just held everything tight. But now we've paid him, you know, and we're partners, and we've reached peace and all this stuff. And And so I say, so Fred, you know, you pushed that peninsula into the swamp, right? Yeah, I did. You were looking for something. Yeah, I was. And you had information about what you were looking for. Yeah, sure did. And so you were pretty sure that was a good spot to look. Yeah, sure was, for sure. Yep. Well, what was it? And he says, oh, well, gosh, it's really nice out today. I think I need to be getting home. He would not do it. He just wouldn't say, you know, and it was very difficult that way.
Fred was so secretive and possessive. This was what Dan Blankenship really resented about him, is that every time he'd find an artifact or something significant, he would take it and add it to his collection, but it would be marked on a map exactly where it was. He had his coordinates were, I mean, it was that specific to the centimeter where it was on the island, but only he had that information. So for Dan, it was like, well, you removed it from where it was so nobody else can find it, and now only you get to know where it was. And that was a sort of...
That got so bitter and so much rancor that those... I think what drove those two guys for 20 years was they were damn sure the other guy wasn't going to beat them to it.
Stop him.
Yeah. And I don't you think?
Oh, yeah. The only reason Fred talked to me is because he wanted to know what Dan had said about him.
So when you and Rick started your quest, did you find it hard to break through with some of these other people? Was there animosity that here's these new guys in town that were coming in?
When we got on the island, the Fred Dan thing was still at full height. I mean, it was the Hatfields and McCoys. There was no cooperation. They were, I won't even tell you some of the stuff, but I mean, they were... At times, Dan had to be disarmed by the Mounties because guns were involved. I mean, nobody ever shot anybody, but I mean, it was real serious stuff. And I would say Rick, you know, I helped, and the rest of the fellowship helped a lot, but it was mainly Rick who wanted, his first objective was to get peace. He always felt if those two cooperated, this thing would have been solved by now. I don't think that, because I think it's tougher than that. But anyway... And so within about 3 years, I think we'd kind of disarmed all that. They never, I don't think...
There was never peace.
There was never affection.
Yeah.
There was peace. There's never affection.
But they respected one another.
Yeah, they did. They did, and that was weird. They did.
Anybody else that when you got there that you figured, I've got to get these people to get on my side, and you know, you talk about Fred and Dan, but the other people that in the families and things, was that tough?
You know, I feel like I was incredibly fortunate in how things came to me. I mean, when I went to the genealogical society and you know, I mean, I guess nobody had thought of like looking in those ancient records, but they had kept everything dating back to the, you know, mid-1700s, and you could actually trace where people came from, who the, you know, the records of their births, marriages, deaths, all of it, and you could really see the fabric of the community and, you know, these people that were involved in the story. So, and they basically handed. They were just so grateful that somebody came to ask them, well, why hasn't anybody come? And so they were open arms and open doors. And as I said, the rest halls, you know, I mean, it was just, you know, some kind of serendipity from my point of view that, you know, I just happened to be there when they happened to be there, and I happened to get them at a moment when they were, you know, both just full of emotion and memory and, you know, just wanted to unburden themselves of the whole story. So, I mean, I didn't suffer many frustrations other than, I mean, Samuel Ball's just about all I can think of something where I was kind of blocked.
Now, my comment on that is quite the contrary. I mean, I have been involved in a fair amount of ventures over the years, and usually there are detractors, you know, there are people who don't want you to succeed. I've never been involved in anything where everybody wants you to succeed. So, I mean, everybody tries to help. It's really, really nice. And in particular, in the Maritimes, everybody knew about Oak Island. And, yeah. And it's woven into their history.
Absolutely.
And so they want to help. We haven't had any trouble with that.
When you talk about the decision way back, and I, you know, we hear the stories, you read the Reader's Digest article about Oak Island as a kid, and that was a fascination to both you and your brother. But talk about the genesis of then finally taking action, say, we're going to go do this.
What happened was, you know, Rick, he hates the word obsession, but I think he's obsessed. And he was, as it grabbed him, and it never let go. And I noticed you said earlier that it was destiny that you were there. And I thought, oh, he's got the sickness.
Oak Islanditis, yeah, they call
he's
it.
He's got the sickness. Because, I mean, it's a common denominator, isn't it? People get obsessed with that island, and they never let go. But anyway, what happened was we went our separate ways. You know, he did his thing, I did mine. But it was our common topic. So every year we'd talk. He followed it. We talk about Oak Island, and I'll make this short. So I got a little break from business, and, you know, we found out that supposedly the island was for sale, but it wasn't. And I'm going to get this all mixed up in terms of time. But we went out there, and we met Dan, which was difficult.
Yeah.
And then we ended up buying just one lot, because David Tobias was selling one lot, which gave us access to the island. And then it took a long time to win Dan over, a long time, because then we became his partner. And that's kind of how it went.
Okay. We're just about out of time, and we're gonna have audience questions.
Okay.
Go ahead. Gentleman right over here.
Hi, this is for Mr. Lagina. Congratulations on your series upcoming. My question is, what are the chances of season 8 occurring, and what factors are you going to consider when making that decision?
There may be some other people in the audience that might want to answer that one. I don't know. You know, I'd it'd be great to solve this thing yet this year. And we have, I will say this, I'm not supposed to say very much about this year, but we're doing a lot in the last 6 weeks, beginning about right now. So I don't know about season 8. You know, I can't really think past that, past what we got right in front of us. So I just don't know. And you know what? Maybe get canceled. Maybe you guys all quit watching. I don't know.
Well, I guarantee you the History Channel's thinking in terms of season 12.
Right over there.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Do you think that the French, after they chased them out of the Templars out of France, do you think that the reason why you found the French helmet on Oak Island is because they chased them all the way there?
You're referring to the Templar theory, right? The Templars did, and it's a cool thing what you bring up, because that did happen. I mean, it's historical fact. The Templars were the wealthiest society, quasi-secret society in Europe at the time. French king turned against them, and frankly, the Pope, and you know, kind of the Knight of the Long Knives, and they were all gathered up because they wanted their money. But the legend is that I think something like 12 ships.
That is the legend.
That's the legend. Left, and were forewarned that this night, and by the way, it was Friday the 13th when it happened, and some people say that's the origins of the bad luck, but they went somewhere. And the legend is they went to Scotland, and maybe some of the knights who fought at Bannockburn, I think, were Templars, is that right?
That's the story.
Yeah. Anyway, is it possible? Yeah, it's possible, but do run-of-the-mill historians say it happened? No, they don't. So it is what Rick wants it to be. It's what a lot of people want it to be because it's so cool, but I'm a little skeptical.
All right, thank you.
Right down there.
There's a new invention. Have you fellas ever heard of dynamite?
Oh, no. No, 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 no. It's not a new invention. Dynamite was used a lot on Oak Island by our predecessors, and I think that's one of the problems. They tried to stop the flood tunnel with dynamite, and I think they made it worse, which, you know, based on what I know of geology, I could have told them that. You know, they just enlarged things. So no, dynamite has been used, and I don't think it would help at this point because, I mean, Dan Blankenship used dynamite because he dug that hole by hand. He and Henske and his son, they dug 10x by hand, an 8-foot hole down to 181 feet by hand. They cut the ends off railroad cars and stacked them up and then got inside and undermined them. So the railroad cars, you know, big tanker cars went down like that. Then they welded another one on and did it again. Did all that by hand, and he was so frustrated that he couldn't get down to the bottom, the very bottom, that he did drop dynamite down there, hoping that he'd blow up a chest and just that one coin would get blown out of the hole. But it didn't happen. So we have, dynamite has been used, and we're not using it anymore.
Next question.
Hi, I'm going to ask the question that everybody here wants to know but are afraid to ask. How much money have you and your brother?
Oh, yeah, good luck.
And your crew put into this project for the last 7 years?
Did you not listen to the song, The Used to Be Millionaire? No, I look, it's a fair question, and I'll answer it somewhat vaguely, but for the first several years, we, the fellowship, put all the money in because, you know, History Channel said, look, we'll film it, but it's your quest. As it became popular, they have put money on the table, and they're paying for a decent chunk of it now. And I'll give you this, you want an aggregate number? It's in the millions. So that's all I can say.
We have time for one more.
Okay, right there.
Hi, Marty. So I know on one of the seasons you guys had started looking at one of the outlying islands. I believe it was Apple Island. And there was some like waiting for permissions, permits, things like that to see if you could dig out there. Have you gotten those permissions and permits? Are you looking at doing that? And if so, do you have any theories about what kind of Bobby Dazzlers you might find out there?
Dan Blankenship, for sure, thought that the other islands that fringe there had some role in it. He was certain of that. I don't exactly know why, but he was quite sure that the workings extended to the other islands. And some of these theorists, which you clearly have seen, have brought that into play. Here's a big problem from my standpoint. Even if they let us dig, we couldn't keep it at all. I mean, if we found something extremely valuable, we'd have a hell of a time keeping it anyway, because there would be claimants. There always are. To big treasures, but out there we don't have any chance. So there's a bit of a split amongst the fellowship as to whether we should put any resources out there.
Everybody say thank you to Randall and Marty.
That was Randall Sullivan and Marty Lagina talking with Patrick Livingston. Randall Sullivan's latest book is The Curse of Oak Island, the story of the world's longest treasure hunt. Support for the National Writers Series is brought to you by the Wege Foundation, dedicated to developing leaders in economic ecology, health, education, and arts, and enhancing the lives of people in West Michigan and around the world. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org, and listen to past programs at interlockinpublicradio.org. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Linnea Melkerrick.